You good to go?
I'm good to go.
All right, we're going. Good morning.
Good morning.
Drinking coffee.
Mm-hmm. It's coffee time.
Mm-hmm.
And as I grumpily look out my window and see snow, yes, I realize I do live in Wisconsin, but and we haven't actually really had any snow in southern Wisconsin up until, well, last night, and now I'm grumpy about it.
Was it significant snow, or?
Not really, but it's snow. You know, it's like 3 inches, and we're going to get another 3 or 4 tonight, but I hate winter, so I was really, really hoping to not see snow this winter, but oh well.
So it's interesting you bring that up, because I know we have things we were planning on talking about today, but I was going to ask you a question if we had time, and I'm just going to ask it now since you're talking about snow. It's going to be 60 degrees here today in Connecticut,
mm-hmm.
and it's going to be 60 again tomorrow, and then it's going to go back down to where it's supposed to be. And we've spoken in the past about the fact that when you get these sudden cold snaps after the plants come out of dormancy in April and May, it can really screw things up. Do these blips of heat in the middle of the dormancy period, can they have an effect as well? Or is that too big a question for us to shoehorn in here?
Now, the short answer is no. It doesn't really matter. Breaking dormancy is not just about temperature. It's also about photoperiod and day length. And that's why plants use photoperiod as the really primary trigger for dormancy breaking, is because you can have these wild swings in temperature that can not be reliable. That's the difference between weather and climate. You know, weather is things that track over a very short period of time, and you get this what we call weather wackiness, where a climate shift, long-term changes, can actually impact the way plants behave in certain regions. So short answer is no. Long answer is sort of.
Sort of. Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. And it's funny because right before we hit the record button, James and I were talking about what we were going to talk about today. Because we talk about what we're going to talk about, then we talk about it. Then when we're done recording, we talk about what we talked about. So it gets a little repetitive. But that did not come up, and it was something that I meant to bring up if we had time. And then you started talking about snow. We've only had pretty snow this year so far, like a half an inch hanging on the trees. Nothing significant enough. I think I pulled the snowblower out once.
There's nothing so about far. Snow that I like. Nothing, like zero. And even my wife's like, "Oh, it's just so gorgeous outside. Look at it. It's framing all the trees." I'm like, "Ugh. It's just makes such a mess. It just causes havoc, and it's just very inefficient."
But you are one of the biggest nature lovers I know. You love everything about nature.
Except snow.
Except snow. Gypsy moth caterpillars?
Yep, no problem.
No problem with them. But you don't like snow.
Right, yep.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, not sure where to go with that, but I...
Right. Well, let's segue into the meat of the issue here.
Okay. Which is housekeeping.
Housekeeping.
Love the new intro music. Love it, love it, love it.
Thank you.
Well done. Very well done. Thank you, Justin Shepherd, our latest patron on Patreon. If you don't know what I'm talking about, go to patreon.com/hapnology and help us keep the beat going on here as we talk about all of this hop and quasi-hop related stuff. Remember, we are having a workshop. It's in full swing now. Registrations are available on February 22nd. We've got a bunch of topics to go over. We mm-hmm. will have live Q&A. You'll get to see James and I, which, you know, that might be, I don't know. We might have to give people a discount after seeing what we look like. I don't know if that's, you know, maybe a thing.
Possibly.
Possibly.
Well, you keep talking about wearing a Speedo, and that's probably what the reason for our low enrollment rate.
Oh,
right now.
Yes. okay, maybe I'll need to back off on the Speedo talk. It's social media. It's the new world. So, along those lines, please join us for the workshop. It will be a lot of fun. February 22nd. Check out the website for details. If you are a patron as of February 1, you'll get invited to a second session to the workshop, some bonus time for direct Q&A, which means you'll be able to bypass the massive crowds we expect to have at this event for some dedicated one-on-one time with James and Ida. Ask whatever questions you got. We will answer any questions. We're hoping they're hop-related, but we're welcome to help you with your marriage or with, issues with your car or your job or whatever else you'd like to talk about.
We are the go-to source for career advice.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So, why don't we take the hops questions first, then we'll get to the other stuff later. I guess that's the whole thing for housekeeping.
Cool. Well, thanks everybody for contributing to our Patreon and signing up for our workshop, and we're looking forward to it. So, let's get into it.
Tech. We've been talking tech first lately. Let's continue that trend. We already talked a little bit about the weather. You were telling me about some issues with brewers complaining about soft mushy hops.
Right. Well, soft mushy pellets.
Pellets.
So pellets. I got an inquiry yesterday, and this is sort of where my latest sort of round of technical stuff is coming from, is just questions people ask me throughout the week and that I think might be of interest to people. And let's take a break from the plant physiology and horticulture, and let's talk about like food processing and stuff. So the pellet, the hop pellet itself, we've talked in the past about why pelletizing is important, and I'll just briefly, go over it here. It densifies the hop material, so it's easier to deal with. It turns a light, fluffy, flaky material into something dense that can be actually poured and flows. So it has a fluidity to it that makes handling in the brew house a far cry simpler than wrestling with whole leaf hops. And some brewers, frankly, have in-tank heat exchangers that will clog if you've got a bunch of fluffy hop bracts from whole leaf hops floating around in there, or from hop pellets that are too fluffy that really aren't densified properly, or maybe they were and they swell later in storage. So the issue at hand was a grower that had some hop pellets that seemed to have lost their density in storage. And I've seen this happen in the past, where you have hops that have high oil content, and they come out of the pellet mill and they look dense, they look fine. They look like you would expect your pellet to look if you've got everything dialed in. And they end up over time like swelling and losing their density. I can't exactly tell you why that's happening. I can only tell you my observations are. In the past, when I've had that happen to me, it's like, okay, well, now I have to make a denser pellet, so I change the pellet mill settings, and I make a pellet that's so dense that it just sinks to the bottom of the brew kettle and is resistant to swelling and breaking apart when it's supposed to in the brewing process. Something for growers to be aware of is the density of a pellet will change based on the variety, and not every variety has a different pellet density, at least that I found, is sort of certain groups. And I've attributed that to oil content. So the lower oil content varieties seem to make a much denser pellet, and they seem to, when you're grinding them in a hammer mill, they seem to make a finer, what we call mill powder. The more oily hops tend to make a bit coarser. And as you would expect, having more oil, the material is more prone to being sticky, and that can clog up screens and all kinds of stuff in your hammer mill. So know that when you're looking at pelletizing, and know what to expect.
And it kind of goes without saying that, because we've talked about this before, but if you're not drying correctly, you're starting from a position so far behind optimal, it's not even funny.
Yeah, correct. And so moisture content, too, is extremely, extremely important when pelletizing. Again, from our experience, what we found is that with a ring die mill, I think we were running California pellet mills, we had a 12 or 14 inch, and then we went up to an 18 or 19 inch die. The moisture content turns your highly tuned operation into, a snail race if you're too high in moisture content. And by too high, what we found was that really anything over about 11%, just the flow through rate just drops precipitously.
Yeah, if you hate the person pelletizing your hops, give them some 14% to process, and that's a great learning experience once.
Yeah, and you're likely to lose your hops, because if they don't throw them out, they're going to give them back to you and say, you got to dry these again. It really does just clog the whole works up, but it also can account for some of this pellet swelling that we see. If you're hovering in that 10 to 12% range, the pellet will come out looking dense. It might be a little fuzzy, but you may be like, oh, that's not bad. You know, as soon as it cools down a little bit, it'll firm up, and it usually does. But what we find is that in storage, certainly if you're in a what we call a pillow pack scenario, where instead of having a hard vacuum on your packaging that sort of holds that pellet in under compression, if you pillow pack and you're injecting inert gas, then that pellet has room to swell and to potentially fall apart. It could also happen that you may be packaging too soon, so the pellet may still be warm and not have these hard resins and waxes that are in the pellet that heat up during pelletizing. Even if you're you know, under 100 Fahrenheit when you're pelletizing, they're still squishy. And they need to sort of cool or anneal, as the jargon is. And that pellet, if not allowed to cool properly and then put into either bulk bins or into bags immediately, we found that they can become a little bit more friable and squishy and not really set up properly. So there's some technique that's involved there to really dial that in. Lots of variables to juggle, and just like hop growing, it's there's no single factor that you can point to. You got to sort of fiddle around with the settings until you find what's causing the issue. But certainly, starting off with hops that are at the right moisture content is going to solve a mountain of problems in the processing. But as a brewer's concerned, you know, what are they doing? So how are they adding their hops? We're talking pellets. So if you're a small brewer, and let's say you've got a 7 to 10 barrel system, you're likely not to have an automatic hop dosing unit, which is basically a small container on the side of the kettle that, well, automatically doses pellets. And in order for that system to work properly, the pellets have to be free flowing. And if you have a loose pellet or a sticky pellet, it's not going to do that, and it's going to clog up that doser. So that's one potential issue that brewers might have with a loose pellet. Another issue is let's say they're just pouring them into the kettle or into the fermenter or into the secondary, wherever they're putting them, that debris, ideally what you want to do on the hot side, if you have too much coarse debris, so let's say you're not grinding the hops fine enough, so you could have a bunch of loose floating debris in there. If they have, like I said earlier, an in-tank heat exchanger, that all that debris could clog that up. And now they're not getting efficient transfer of heat into their kettle, and it's a pain in the butt to have to tear that apart and clean it out. On the cold side, either in the fermenter or in the secondary where they're dry hopping, it really is an art to get that pellet just right. Ideally, what you want is a pellet that's dense enough to sink and not float on the top, and then swell and break apart and sort of make this sort of zone of hoppiness, like right in the middle of that tall cylinder. If the pellet's too dense, boom, it's going to sink to the bottom, and the extraction rate is going to be lower. If the pellet's too loose, or in the case of, like, if you're using whole leaf hops, they can float on the top, and you don't get good uniform mixing within that cylinder. So getting it dialed in for the quote proper hop density is kind of a black art, but it's something that growers, I think, should be aware of, because brewers will oftentimes, they'll make comments, well, these pellets are too hard, these pellets are too soft. But for another brewer, it may be just fine. So you kind of need to know that. And I think if you look at the large scale hot pelletizing operations, they sort of shoot for a happy medium because they know they're not going to make everybody happy. And so I think from an industry standpoint, most brewers are expecting a harder pellet just because it ships easier. You know, there's not so much breakage in shipping and storage and handling, and it flows a lot easier in these automatic dosing systems, which large breweries have, as opposed to, you know, what the smaller scale non-traditional grower is going to be able to get for a pellet from either their own system or a contract manufacturer. They may have more questions or comments made about their pellets compared to like Yakima Chief or Barth Haas, who have these massive giant, you know, facilities and quality control systems and all this kind of stuff. So I thought we ought to just touch on that.
Yeah, very important to understand all that piece of it. And, you know, you said you'll get feedback from brewers, but, you know, a brewer at that point is the consumer of your product, just like any other consumer. How many times have you or I or anyone else bought something once, said, man, that didn't work out the way I wanted to, and you go and buy from someone else next time? So you may not even get the feedback you need before it's too late. You need to do as much quality control up front as you can.
You can, and you can ask. And I realize that there's the really tricky line to walk, whether you're a small-scale hop grower or you're a small-scale brewer or whatever, where it's like, uh-oh, this didn't turn out the way I wanted to, but can I really afford to not sell it? I can't tell you how many brewers I've run into where it's like, oh man, this beer is, you know, or these hops I put in this beer were bad and the beer is not great, but yet they won't dump it because they can't, because they have so much invested in that liquid that if they dump it, it's a complete loss. Whereas they're like, well, if I blend it with something, can I at least sell it and recoup something, right? And small scale growers are, you know, no different. And frankly, there's a lot of manufacturing folks that are no different. You know, how do you make a silk purse out of a sow's ear? Is that what that's called?
Yes,
so,
it is.
So what do you do in that scenario? Well, you can reprocess those pellets. And I've done that in the past where the pellets come out. You're like, ooh, yeah, no good. Run them back through. Is it really great for the hop? No, but it's better than throwing them out. And if you do it quickly, you know, like if it's coming out the back end of the pellet mill and you're like, whoa, these pellets are way too soft, you're just not going to pitch those. You're going to put them back in the process and repelletize them with slightly different settings. It's another thing altogether if you've got old pellets, you know, from the cooler or whatever, and you open them up and they're a year old or a year and a half old. Are you really going to repelletize those? Probably not. Not at that point, because you've got newer crop coming in behind it. And it's probably not worth it at that point. So these are trade-offs that one has to make, but just be aware that certainly if you're not pelletizing your own hops and you're getting them from someone else, understand what sort of their expectation is for pellet density. And maybe later in another episode, we'll talk about how pellet density is measured and what sort of the metrics are around that.
Yes, that's something we definitely will need to get into. And I'm curious to hear from our listeners, because we talk mostly, as you mentioned earlier, about plant physiology, and I've been sitting here, fingers on the keys, waiting for a brewing term that sounds like made-up gibberish, but I think you just save all those for the plant physiology side of things.
A brewing term that sounds like gibberish?
Yeah.
Oh, I'll have to think of some.
Yeah, you'll have to give me something in there. You can put it in the tag at the end if you want, so I don't have time to retort it.
Okay.
But, you know, this brewing side of it is, it's so important to understand how what you're doing ends up going in there. And even as a grower, if you're not going to pelletize, but you're paying someone else to pelletize, you want to make sure they're doing it right. So you need to understand how this gets to its final destination in the beer properly.
And if you are the pelletizer, understand, you know, how to clearly communicate what that grower is going to see back, right? So manage their expectation and say, you know, this is what we pelletize to, and this is what you may see back. This is our ranges, because it's kind of a cover your ass scenario, but also you want to be upfront and forthright with people. This is a variable product. You may have different varieties with slightly different densities just based on the chemical makeup.
I'd say most, if not all, of the questions we receive and the comments we get back have to do with growing. I would love love to hear from some of our listeners, if there are any, who are doing their own processing, so we can understand some of the, some of the nightmare stories from the pelletizing process. That could be a fun episode all in and of itself if we get some feedback from a few folks on things that have gone haywire.
Oh, yeah.
Or, more importantly, how to dial it in the right way.
Right. Yeah, we always like to hear about the recovery because that tells the whole story.
Yep. We learn so much from that failure. We've talked about it before. That's how we improve.
That's why I like to say, we're giving talks and whatnot. I like to say, why am I up here speaking as the expert? Because I've screwed this up more than you have. That's why. So.
Yep. That plays also well into my comment earlier that we won't only answer hop questions on the webinar. We'll talk about, relationship advice and career advice. We got between the two of us, I feel like we have centuries of experience to.
We do. We do. Yes.
Oh my.
Nice. All right. Well, enough of that jibber jabber. What do you got to talk about on the market business side today?
Well, so we had been talking about a link. There are a lot of good websites out there, also a lot of bad websites, but there are plenty out there where you can follow the alcohol industry, the beer industry. There's one called Hop Culture, and they were talking about 10 trends in the craft beer industry to watch out for in 2020. And thought it'd be interesting to walk through this a little bit and talk about what is interesting to us, what's not. There are a couple things on here that are going to make us both cringe and that we've complained about before. But I'm curious what their perspective as a journalistic site is about what's going on in the industry. And as we get into that, something I wanted to mention again to our listeners, it's a new year. They're talking about trends here in 2020. If you have, as a grower, your goals for the year, what are you planning to do this year? Whether it's a new hop yard or expansion, or if you're opening a brewery, if you're a brewery in planning, we'd love to hear about some of our listeners and what big plans you got for this year.
Mm-hmm.
Other than just hanging out and listening to us, which is fine too.
Well, it is fine, but I mean, all the cool kids are doing it. But what do you want as a listener? What are your plans, and then what do you want to hear from us in 2020?
That as well.
Otherwise, we're just going to keep yammering with our same old format. And if we don't hear anything from you guys, then nothing's going to change.
So. Very true. Very, very true. We are at your disposal. Let us know what you'd like to hear.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, so Hop Culture, what did they have to – what are their prognostications for 2020?
So the first one they've got, which I think is interesting, and you and I have talked about this a little bit, is growing diversity in craft beer. Diversity in terms of the faces, as opposed to the stereotypical young white guy with a really long curly beard.
Right, wearing plaid.
Wearing plaid. And the most interesting thing about that just takes me back to a conversation you and I had when we started this podcast. We had talked about having some of our friends who are brewers on, and someone had suggested to us on Instagram, how about talking to women in craft beer. And I recall your comment to me was, the women I know who are brewmasters are so tired of being known as women who are brewmasters as opposed to brewmasters.
Right.
That, why the focus on that aspect of who they are isn't what they want. They want to be known for making good beer.
Correct. Yep. And it's probably reflective of where I live, right, in Madison, Wisconsin, but we have a high density of brewers and of all genders, let's put it that way. And we have a high degree of diversity in our brewing culture here. But the women specifically that I know brewing, they're sick of it. It was kind of a novelty a while back, and I think they feel, at least some of them feel like that's the scenario still. So they just want to focus on being brewers.
Yeah.
And being good brewers, and that's it.
I get it. It's too easy to cross the line into pandering. Mm-hmm. If you're not careful. And let's just talk, we're here to talk about quality product and the quality people that put out a quality product.
But I do believe that certainly the craft beer industry suffers from a diversity issue, a skin tone issue, and a gender issue.
Yep.
And I'm glad to see, to have some light shine on that. But at the same time, I don't want it to become a PC sort of thing where it's like, well, we have 10 breweries in our town, and but not enough of them are
minority owned.
Minority owned, run by, you know, whomever. Really? Do they make good beer? That's what I'm after. Mm-hmm. So that's my take on that.
Beer should cross all boundaries.
Correct.
And the more of you have it that you have, the more likely you are to espouse things like that.
And so I think that's an important fact, because maybe it's less about diversity in the manufacture of the beer and improving the diversity in the consumption of the beverage.
That could be a whole episode right there. That's very interesting. That's a very interesting point. There's a lot to that. And as we'll get into some of the other topics here, there are definitely some new entries into the space which clearly are targeted at certain populations.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so the next one on their list, and we just had this conversation, is a focus on craft malt, mm-hmm. of all things. And I think it was just a week or two ago, we were talking about the fact that all of, you know, hops are being used as a branding element. It's pretty common now with all these sexy hop names. They used to be named after the regions where they were grown. Now, I think my comment was they're named after porn stars now.
Right, right.
But we had discussed the fact that you don't see beers that say contains yeast ABC because it's just boring. And the same with malt, but you're starting to see these craft maltsters pop up. And that's becoming a real thing. And they're just like there is to hop growing and hop processing. There is a craft to malting. And you want it done correctly. And that local aspect starts to feed in freshness and everything.
The freshness aspect and just hop quality from a food processing standpoint is important. But in malting, food safety is enormous. Because, I mean, you could kill people if that malt is infected with something called a vomitoxin.
Sounds like a rat thing.
Malting has a bit of a different requirement in terms of food safety. So I know a lot of hop growers that have said, we're growing hops, let's do malt too. How hard can it be? It's a whole different animal. So hats off to the maltsters. I've done some malting myself on a very small scale, mostly alternative grain malting, not barley, but still the issues still hold. That whole new undiscovered country there. So
it's interesting stuff. And one of the local breweries here by me did a night for their coaster club, their mug club members, where they brought in a local maltster who they use for most of their malt. And we did a little brewery tour, and they had everyone seeing the different malts and smelling them as they ran them through water and got that, you could sense that, smell that different flavor from each of them, because everyone just assumes the hop is the be-all end-all. It's interesting, the comment here in this article says, if malt is a potato, then hops are salt. Which I think is actually a really good description of how they layer in the beer.
Mm-hmm.
But it was so interesting to see a lot of these folks that were, you know, just there for the beer that came with the tour, really had an eye-opening in terms of, wow, the malt is important. There's really, and of course, we're preaching to the choir here, the folks that are growing hops. You know more about this than your general, I'll say, drunken consumer. Mm-hmm. But interesting to get that information out there that, yes, there's more to this beer than just the hops that are going into it.
Nice.
So the next one, which we can talk about forever or not for very long at all, is alternative beverages. And of course, it's a picture of a whole bunch of ciders and seltzers. And we've talked about this. And I guess I know my feeling on that is that's fine. They're new category entries. The fact that it's beer companies doing them and not dedicated, I don't know. I find the fact that those are being labeled as a beer extension is odd to me. They're not beer. But they are taking away some of our drinking population, without question.
They are. So I'm of two minds of this, as everyone knows. So the first one is, if it hard, sparkly beverages attract those people who were influencing the god-awful, juicy, dank trend in beer, I'm all for it. Get those palates out of beer, and I'm a happy man. So we can get back to actual beer that tastes like beer. That's number one. But number two, I sort of hold this idea of brewers making malt seltzers, hard seltzers, sort of like saying, hop growers also growing hemp because it's the next big thing, right? And, oh, well, they're sort of related. So why not, you know, they utilize some of the same equipment. So why not? Why not go for it? It just, I don't know. It seems like trend chasing to me again. I'm not saying that I disrespect brewers for wanting to do that because they're trying to run a business. I get it, but it just seems disingenuous.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. It's the next level. I mean, we all remember Zima.
Not all of us do remember Zima. So remember how old you are.
Okay, I'm not that much older than you.
But you might be from our listening audience.
That's true. So Zima with a Z. There'll always be something different to try. It has taken the world by storm, but we are a fad culture. We are I'm saying this for the second time this episode, a FOMO, a fear of missing out culture where, ooh, there's something new. And look, I am the first person who, when I walk through the supermarket, when frickin' Lay's potato chips is putting on some weird flavor that's limited edition, I'm buying it because God forbid I don't see it the next time I'm in there. So I'm just as guilty as anyone else of wanting to try something before it's gone. But we'll see what the future holds for this stuff. I mean, so again, dating myself, when I was growing up, even before Zima, wine coolers first came on the
scene. Oh, yeah. Bartles and James.
And there was another one, which is no longer around. I forget. It was Bartles and James, and there was one other brand, and it wasn't Seagram's, who seemed to have the market now. But if you didn't like beer, and especially if you were a teenage girl, oh, my God, wine coolers were like, this is fruit juice. And now I can't stand up. This is the best thing ever.
Yep. Exactly.
And that at the time, it wouldn't shock me if we could go back in time, years, to when that happened, if the wine purists were positively freaking out, going, what are you doing? All the hard work that goes into creating these flavors and you know, all of the science and all the care that goes into this, and you're just combining sugar and chemicals and making something fruity and silly, and now my population aging into real drinking is never going to go that way because you're drinking this shit. It wouldn't surprise me if they had a similar situation going on than we're seeing now with the seltzers from a purist perspective.
There's a term for these that I just looked up, and it's going to drive me nuts because I hate these sort of mashup names. So right now, the brand who owns the industry is Smirnoff Ice. Right. They're the big ones. Right. And then you've got Mike's Hard, whatever. But they're called these ready to drink malt beverages, often called malternatives.
Oh, yuck.
Yeah. Are because they are similar to beer in that they come in a variety of flavors, and they're malt. They're not just ethyl alcohol diluted with flavorings. If a brewer is going to make them and not be labeled a distillery or something else. I don't remember exactly, but they have to be made from some sort of fermented maltose or sugar-based thing. So they're making malt liquor, which is exactly what Zima was, and it failed because, well, I think poor marketing and image, but anyway, we're down the rabbit hole.
We are, but it did, I mean, remember, it failed, but after first being huge for a very, very short period of time.
Yeah.
So who knows where we'll go with the hard seltzers. So yeah, I thought that was extremely interesting. We could talk about this for hours and hours, so we should move on from that topic because we have lots of opinions there.
Yep.
But I hadn't thought about the wine cooler parallel till just now, but I think there's something to be said there. So the next topic here, and I know you're just going to throw up now, is fresh hop beers.
Sure.
And this is interesting because the problem with fresh hop beers is, from a year-round perspective, is that you need fresh hops.
Yep.
And you can't fly fresh hops from a different part of the world that's in the hop growing season to get them to your fresh hop beer because they won't be fresh anymore.
Right.
So you've got a limited time window to do this in. And I view a fresh hop beer as something akin to an Oktoberfest or you know, it's got a seasonality to it. There's a time of year where you want that. Now, I know what you're going to say. There's never a time of year where you should watch
that. Yeah, I'm the grumpy bastard that doesn't like anything.
I'll just play both of our parts for this session.
Okay, yeah, sure.
Because I know exactly what you're going to say. I like them. I know you think they taste like you're eating grass clippings. I get it.
Yep,
I get it.
Yep.
But that it's interesting they're calling this out as a trend. Other than Sierra Nevada, who does it on a year-round basis with the Celebration Ale, I don't know who else actually does this on a year-round basis. And, of course, they've got the ability to get whatever they want whenever they want it. So,
well, they have their own hop yards specifically for that. So, I mean, okay, that's one way to handle the supply chain. But is that a role for hydroponic hops, right, in greenhouse production? I don't know. It's probably a niche market there. Well, I know there's a niche market there, but I don't know what the business dynamics look like. You're correct. I don't care for them, but obviously lots of people do. And a lot of these lists always seem to be like, okay, we have to write an article about the next trends. What are boutique things in the industry that we could talk about and we can say they're going to be the next big thing? Well, what hops? Fresh hops, because they're rare, right? And they're sort of another color of hop that you can talk about because hops are sexy right now. So I don't see it being a next big trend just because there's no way to supply the market.
Yeah, and even the last line of their article, they say, expect breweries fortunate enough to be in proximity to hop farms to follow suit. And it's a logistics issue.
It's a huge
logistics issue. I still would argue it's also an issue of the time of year and what we're expecting. If you saw an Oktoberfest come out in February, and you could make an Oktoberfest, we've talked about this with pumpkin beer as well, you can make it any time of the year you want. But there's a time of the year the market is expecting it and demanding it. And once you put it out in other places, maybe you'll get a burst of, ooh, a February Oktoberfest. What a cool little concept. And maybe you get a little burst, but then you'd end up taking away some of what makes that special.
You'd hear, at least around here, you hear nothing but bitching. They'd be like, February, this is supposed to be box season, Oktoberfest. What are you doing?
I think it just would be confusing and unwanted. And it would hurt the sales in season when they're supposed to happen. So you end up taking something special and removing what's special about it. But that, again, that's a market theory with zero evidence behind it other than my opinion.
I would say for our friends growing hops for the wet market, continue to do so if you have a market.
Yeah.
If that's your angle, more power to you and promote it, and we'll do what we can to help you. But as far as an industry trend to watch in 2020, I don't buy it.
I don't either. I don't even want to discuss this next one because the picture is making me ill, but I'm going to. It's a picture of a donut being dipped in a dark beer, and it says, continuation of lactose. Hate it. I take that back. I've tasted these. They're interesting, even though they are more beer than any other of these things we've talked about. They fall to me outside of the beer category. I just don't enjoy them at all.
I don't mind lactose in a milk stout where it belongs. Adding it to everything, it's just right out.
It's more, to me, of a mouthfeel thing. It adds a texture.
Yeah.
That, again, you're going after the non-beer market to a degree. I mean, this beer is an imperial stout that they're showing with cocoa nibs, vanilla, coffee, and lactose.
It's the pastry stout trend,
stout.
Yeah. And just like, okay. I mean, I've had some barley wines that are super sweet and ultra boozy, and they're dessert beers, more or less. And experiment with it. That's great. You want to make a Count Chocula milk stout? Fantastic. But will I try it? Yep. But I'm not going to buy a six-pack of it. I'm not going to drink a whole pint of it. I'll get maybe a 5 ounce, if that, because it's just not my bag.
I'll try them as well. And honestly, for me, and this is just, you know, everyone's got their own taste, even a milk stout, to me, I prefer a nitro. I prefer something without the lactose, but that's just me personally. Mm-hmm. But when you get into all this sugary stuff, it just pulls you away.
Yeah.
So this next category, I'll be honest, I've never tried one of these. I don't know if you have. And I have not seen many of them around. It's a rosé beer. a beer using grapes and with a wine lean toward it.
Yep.
Have you tried any of them?
I have. And actually, the first ones I had were in New Zealand a few years ago. Meh, I'm not a wine fan, so guess what I'm going to say?
Yeah.
You know, people looking for the next big thing. I don't know. I have nothing to add on that topic.
So that's what, you know, let us know if you like that stuff. I don't know. It looks to me like a halfway point between a beer and a hard seltzer, personally.
Yeah,
but I don't know. I don't know. It just doesn't seem – I don't get that. They actually split out an entire category. They were running, to your point, they were told to write an article with 10 items, and they were running out of ideas. They have a whole secondary category dedicated to seltzer, which we've talked about already. This I thought was interesting. It's different than what we've been discussing. Experiential tap rooms. So tap rooms that are more than just, you know, tables and the exposed ceiling and the things we've talked about before as typical tap room. But, you know, tap rooms, the picture they've got here looks like one set up for a wedding reception. I know there's a new brewery that they're building near me, and they keep on posting pictures of the granite countertops that they got from some shut down mansion somewhere. You know, they're trying to make it into more of an experience situation than just, hey, come here and have a beer.
But I mean, what's the experience? I mean, are they gonna have like jugglers wandering around? I mean, what?
God, I hope so. I hope so. I would love that.
I don't want clowns messing with my beer. So what's experiential about it?
We're done talking about seltzers, so the clowns messing with your beer part is over.
Okay. Thanks, folks. He's here all week. Try the veal.
Again, I think this is a reach of, you know, just trying to find something to talk about. You know, tap rooms come in all shapes and sizes. I've been to a couple lately, tiny little holes in the wall. I think I mentioned a few weeks ago, I was at the New England Cider Company, which is smaller than my walk-in closet in my bedroom, but adorable. And that's great. So I don't know. I don't know that a large, enormous tap room, I kind of feel like you need the volume before you can commit to all that space.
I don't understand what experiential tap room means. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're going to a tap room, you're going to have a beer experience. I'm not going to go to a tap room to have an experience of, I don't know. I mean, that to me takes away from the beer. I don't know.
Yeah.
Every business is looking for an angle. I mean, you've got to have a hook. But most tap rooms, if your hook isn't your beer, something, what are you doing?
Yeah, I would agree. And some of it comes down to personal preference. I mean, I want a tap room where I can have a conversation. I will avoid trivia nights and bands. Oh, yeah. And I feel hard about avoiding bands because I play in bands in tap rooms. And I want people to come see me. But when I'm going to talk with my friends, I don't want to have to over talk the music. And some tap rooms are better than others by keeping that volume at a reasonable level. But everyone's looking for something different. I like the quiet. To me, beer is best shared and enjoyed in conversation, and you need a certain atmosphere for that. So the next one here is lagers coming back, which I think is wonderful.
Huzzah!
Hooray!
It doesn't have lactose in it.
Oh my God, no. Ooh, yeah. I was, and some of those styles, the lagers, the pale ales, you're starting to see them come back. I was in one of my local places the other day, and I was talking to one of the owners, and they had put a new IPA on like 3 weeks before, and it was about to go off, and they had just put on another one and a new pale ale they put out, which I tried, and it was wonderful, and I told them so. And he said, you know, if we'd been 2 weeks earlier on this one, that last IPA would have lasted longer, because right now we are heavy on the dark. They had at the time three stouts and a porter, which I'm in heaven right there with three stouts and a porter on a tap menu. And their lighter menu was light. And they also just pulled a lager off that went over very well. So you're starting to see, I hope, at least this one example, people who, you know, like their IPAs, but will try a lager, will try a pale ale and get back into what is, I guess you and I would call real beer.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, with them duplicating their stories here, the next one they're calling out are, they're grouping together hazy IPAs, dessert stouts, which we really already talked about, and fruited sours. I'm seeing the sours back off a little bit. Maybe it's just me.
They're still pretty strong here. It's certainly more of a seasonal thing. We'll see more of them in the warmer months. But they're, of the, quote, trendy beer styles, they're a challenge to make, and they pose some real risks in the brew house. So you have, I think, a lot less experimentation going on there and less willingness to go all in. Some breweries in Wisconsin, anyway, have dedicated sour brew houses.
Yep.
They are all in a big way and sort of owning the space just because there's a bit more of a barrier to entry.
The Two Roads out here by me, which is one of the larger growing ones, they originally had a sour, they called them their tanker series, and they did sours in tanker trucks out in the parking lot, which was kind of a neat thing when you pulled into the parking lot to see these tankers. And then they opened an entire second brew house they call Area 2, kind of a callback to Area 51, mm-hmm. and it's all about sours. So they've gone all in, but to your point, they've kept it separate. And certainly they'll serve both types of beer in both tap rooms. But in terms of the brewing, it is a separate functionality they're trying to keep there.
I would just say for growers listening to this, it comes back to you need to pay attention to what the trends are so you know how to position yourself. Take a look at maybe some of these trends as an opportunity for diversification in your operation. Maybe need if botanicals are going to be a big thing in seltzers and these other brewing trends, then maybe take a look at adding some of that to your operation, just to make sure that you've got a backup to your hop market.
And from a marketing and sales perspective, when you are at a brewery and you're trying to strike up a conversation with the brewer, the owner behind the bar, they don't necessarily want to hear you lead with, "I'm a hop grower," because you've got an agenda then. Start asking some of these questions, because mm-hmm. this is an area that they'll talk about, and then you segue into the fact that, well, you know, I'm growing hops. You've established yourself as someone who knows the industry a little bit at that point, so it helps as an entry point for that sale.
Yep, know your customer's business as well as your own. It's kind of a cover-your-ass scenario,